I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's been a major break in one of the last unsolved crimes of the civil rights era. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez today announced the arrest.
There was no statute of limitations for this crime, and there is no statute of limitations on the pain in a human heart or the memory of the appalling things that were done in cases like this one.
71-year-old James Seal, a former Mississippi Klansman, was arraigned today on federal kidnapping charges in the case of two 19-year-old black men who disappeared and were found brutally killed in 1964. At one point, authorities thought Seal was dead, but a brother of one of the victims tracked him down, eventually leading to Seal's arrest yesterday. Donna Ladd is editor of the Jackson Free Press. She's now on assignment in Meadville, Mississippi, where the victims originally disappeared. Donna, start by telling us what officials are accusing James Seal of doing to these two victims, Charles Eddie Moore and Henry Hezekiah D.
Well, it's alleged that he picked up these hitchhikers. In fact, I'm standing here near the spot in Meadville where they picked them up right now, and took them to a national forest, tied them to a tree, and beat them nearly lifeless with these long, skinny sticks. And it was a whole crowd of Klansmen who kind of arrived on the scene. They called for more Klansmen for backup, and then they took them over to an offshoot of the Mississippi River, tied Jeep engine parts to them, and dropped them into the river.
Klan informants said this at the time, but the irony is that at the same time these two young men went missing, three other young men went missing. That's James Chaney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner.
Well, that's right.
The infamous civil rights workers who were featured in the film Mississippi Burning. So how did that affect this case?
These were two black men in Mississippi, and frankly, even the national media coverage wasn't, it wasn't the same. These were two young men who didn't have any kind of power behind them, and people just didn't pay the same amount of attention, except for the FBI. And that's what's interesting when you get into the files, is that they really investigated this case.
Except that because they were consumed with the national case of Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner, they turned it over to local officials. But why was it then dropped by local officials?
Well, what's interesting about that story is that once they were actually arrested and they were supposed to go to trial, their friends and family in this area spread the rumor that they had been roughed up and treated poorly by the FBI agents and the law enforcement. So it kind of gave the local authorities, the district attorney, the excuse to drop the case, as if, they really needed them often in the 60s, but so they dropped the case.
Right.
And so it just went nowhere. And when you read the FBI files, you can tell that it was frustrating these agents that put a lot of time into it then.
Right. Well, then in 2000, the Justice Department Civil Rights Unit reopened the case, and we understand that the brother of one of the victims, Thomas Moore, the brother of Charles Eddie Moore, was dogged in his pursuit of James Seal. The thinking was that James Seal had died.
Well, I think that when reporters would call on the telephone, they would say, oh, he's died.
Yeah.
And I think it was that simple, to be honest with you. So that went out there, and that's what people believed. So they didn't think that there was any chance of doing anything in this case. Sadly, it's very easy to find out when you're down here that he's alive, because I was down here with Thomas, and we found out within 2 days.
This is, again, Thomas Moore, the brother.
Thomas came here not believing he was alive.
Yeah.
He came back to just try to get interest in the case because Killen had been prosecuted, and he thought, okay, it's my turn. I want justice, too. Edgar Ray Killen was convicted in 2005 for manslaughter for Chaney, Goodman, and Schwerner.
Donna, how significant is this arrest in terms of the civil rights cases in your area?
It's significant for those of us here from Mississippi, natives, who want to see... we don't want it to be the end of the line with Edgar Ray Killen. We've got families out there like Thomas Moore who are hurting because of these young black men who were killed here that no one has ever been interested in.
Thank you, Donna. Donna Ladd, editor of the Jackson Free Press in Jackson, Mississippi, speaking to us about the arraignment today of James Seal, the former Klansman allegedly connected to the killing of two young black men in the 60s. Well, the daughter of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has made another controversial road trip documentary. Her first was what some said was a too flattering portrait of then-candidate George W. Bush. This new film is about Christian evangelicals in the U.S. Friends of God by Alexandra Pelosi premieres on HBO tonight. It features a Christian wrestling match, a drive-through church booth where the occupant will say a quick prayer for you when you pull up to the window, the Christian miniature golf course complete with a life-size empty tomb of Jesus, and now disgraced evangelical leader, the Reverend Ted Haggard. Now, Haggard has since resigned from his leadership roles because of a gay relationship. But in this scene, standing with Pelosi outside his Colorado Springs megachurch, he casually talks with members of his church about evangelical sex lives.
How often do you have sex with your wife?
Every day.
Every day? How about twice a day sometimes? Okay, how about you?
Yeah. Every day.
Every day. Let's say out of 100 times when you have sex, what percentage does she climax?
Everyone.
Everyone.
Definitely.
How about you?
Everyone.
Okay.
Everyone. Definitely.
These guys, who would have thought these are a bunch of studs? Look at them.
That's right.
Look at that. We got to join this church. There's a lot of love in this place.
There's a lot of love in this place. And you don't think these babies just come out of nowhere, do you?
Well, as we said, Ted Haggard would resign as head of the National Association of Evangelicals, and it was just days after this film was finished. 36-year-old director Alexandra Pelosi lives in New York City, and she joins us now on the line. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show.
And you know, to your new film in a moment, but we just had to ask you, what did you think when President Bush uttered those words in his State of the Union speech Tuesday night? Madam Speaker.
Well, it was surreal, obviously. You know, my mother was a stay-at-home mom. She planned birthday parties and drove carpool and made her Halloween costumes. And she didn't go into politics until I went to college. So for all of us housewives at home, it's inspiration that we can have life after our children grow up.
Well, in fact, we understand you gave birth to this new film and your child.
Yes, in the days same
later.
Week,
right,
basically.
So we'll let you get back to that child, but let's get back to the film. And I'll admit, as someone who has also labored over a documentary, I found myself thinking, I wonder if she got this opportunity with HBO because she has an in. But it is very soon revealed that you have a remarkable ability to get people to talk to you. First of all, how would you describe your approach to the evangelicals? And you know, who are you in this film?
Well, first of all, you have to understand, I made two documentaries with a $1,000 handheld camera. I would get in the car, drive across the country, and talk to people. Now, when people think of cameras showing up, they think of lights, they think of microphones, they think of a production. I'm a one-man show. So I would show up into some town, and I would go to some church, and I would walk in the front door, and I would stick around for a couple weeks before I'd even turn on my camera. So I really got to know the people that I was talking to.
Well, that's how it feels. It feels like you just talking, and talking sometimes flippantly. I mean, you know, you make no bones that you're an outsider to this culture.
Well, I was born in San Francisco, and I live in New York. So to me, evangelical Christians are foreign. And I was mocking myself when I would walk in and I would say, you know, I'm from New York and I feel like I'm on a National Geographic here coming to study evangelicals, you know. So it was sort of flipped because it was a little bit like, I don't know any evangelicals. What are you guys like? What did you watch TV? Do you, you know, it was sort of, I was the first to point out how funny it was that I was so ignorant about the evangelical movement.
Well, and maybe that's why so many speak to you. And by the way, every time we, you know, touch on this topic, we hear from people who say, wait a minute, I'm evangelical Christian and I am not in a mega church. I am maybe gay. I am, you know, many different things that aren't in the stereotype. Who are the people you were meeting across the country? It's a very specific group.
Well, I wanted to go talk to people that had beliefs that were new to me. For example, I was raised in a Catholic school. The nuns taught me everything I know, but they taught us evolution. So it was interesting to walk into the Answers in Genesis ministry and say, so explain this whole creationism thing to me because I was taught evolution.
And in fact, this is a concerted effort also to teach little children that evolution is wrong and creation is right. Let's listen to a little bit of that scene.
Put your hand up if you've heard that people came from ape-like creatures or something like that. You know, I think just about everybody in the world has heard those things. And I want to tell you right from the start here, I don't believe that dinosaurs lived millions of years ago, and I certainly don't believe that you came from ape-like creatures or anything like that.
What was your thought watching that?
Well, they're indoctrinated at an early age to believe certain things, just like we're all indoctrinated at an early age to believe certain things. I was indoctrinated in the Democratic Party at an early age, so I didn't really place judgments on these kids. I just felt like it was interesting to see that they were taught how to refute evolution. It's interesting to know that there is a ministry traveling this country teaching kids how to refute evolution. And it's working because 50 million Americans don't believe in evolution.
And you do come to Ted Haggard at some point, as we said. Now, he's very succinct about evangelicals. He tells you, you know, his definition is, you know, we believe literal translation of the Bible and that Jesus Christ is our Savior.
Right. And remember, I chose Pastor Ted to be my tour guide through the Red States a year before he fell from grace. He was the spokesman for the National Association of Evangelicals. He had a conference call with the White House every week. He was a very powerful man. He spoke for 30 million evangelicals. That's why I chose him. And it turned out we got along famously because he really understood where I was coming from and he understood that the whole world was foreign to me.
Well, you also went on a hiking trip with him. He taught you how to shoot a rifle.
Yeah, we went to the top of Pikes Peak.
Did you have any hints along the way about his other life?
Well, no. I mean, he was married and he had five children. When I got back to New York, people would say to me, you know, what's wrong with your gaydar? You must have known he was gay. But to see someone in their natural habitat with a family with five kids, I roasted marshmallows in his backyard with his family. I mean, there's no way I would have thought he was gay.
And here you are. You have all this footage. Your thoughts when he turned out to be so different. I mean, he was talking about sexuality right in front of you.
Well, what was interesting about that, and the reason I included it in the documentary, was because the issues that the evangelicals talk about are all related to sex. The two main priorities of the conservative evangelicals are abortion and gay marriage, which are related to sex in some way. So it seemed strange to me that they talked about sex so much. So that's why I thought it was important to include that in the documentary. It's not as if, you know, I included it after the fact once he was involved in a sex scandal. It was always in there. That documentary was edited and delivered before any of that ever happened.
Well, you ended up explaining all of that in a disclaimer, edited out some scenes. But let's move on. What about other situations that you found in the course of making the film? Here you are almost goading your subjects with your, you know, San Francisco liberalism. Did anyone ever try to convert you?
I was saved five times a day everywhere I went because every conversation started with, what do you believe? They would ask me 100 questions before they'd ever answer one. And they would put me on the hot seat before they'd ever, you know, they weren't going to just let me ask all the questions. They would ask me questions, too.
Filmmaker Alexandra Pelosi brings us up to the break. Before we take a break, let's hear another scene from her documentary, Friends of God. This is a drive-through prayer booth.
Hi, how are you doing today? How can we pray with you today?
Is this the church of the future?
I know we are. Let's pray.
And they do. Alexander Pelosi's new film, again, is called Friends of God. It's on HBO. Back with more in a moment. You know, some of the criticism that she maybe got too close. Other criticism that maybe she treated her subjects as foreigners, and they make up a huge number of Americans. More with Alexander Pelosi when we come back. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Alexandra Pelosi, the filmmaking daughter of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Alexandra's new documentary on Christian evangelicals is called Friends of God. It's interesting. Her critics say both that she gets too close to her subjects and that she views evangelicals, who make up a large number of Americans, from a distance, as if they were space aliens. Supporters of her style say she lets evangelicals speak for themselves. But, Alexandra, another criticism is that you don't challenge them on issues like evolution.
Well, I didn't think that was necessary because they don't have HBO in those parts where I was. They're not big watchers of HBO. So this was more for the people that watch HBO that don't know evangelicals. I mean, there's no reason for me to start a fight with someone about what I believe versus what they believe. That's not really going to open the conversation. I wanted to focus more on what we had in common, or just explain to me what you believe, just so we know what it is. I didn't think that, you know, I try not to bring any agenda to my work because I feel like that undermines everything, especially considering when the thing comes out, all they're going to say is, you're the speaker's daughter, and therefore you have a liberal agenda.
Right.
So it doesn't even help to bring up my politics. My politics will be used against me whether I like it or not. There's no reason to insert it into the movie. And remember, this is an hour of television. I only had an hour. For 2 years, I had 1 hour. So you don't really have time to get deep into the issues in this case.
Meanwhile, it becomes a real window into a whole world and an often entertaining one at times. As we said, Christian wrestling. By the way, let's listen to a little of that.
Well, I'm a president and founder of the Christian Wrestling Federation. We've been around about 5 years. And what we do is we took pro wrestling, cleaned it up, and put a gospel message to it. So we travel all over the country. We'll wrestle 4 or 5 matches.
This looks like it hurts.
I've broken both my thumbs. I've had shoulder problems, back problems.
It's a lot of pain for Christ.
Yes, it is. But you know what? It's all worth it because when you think about the pain Christ went through on the cross for us, this pales in comparison.
What's interesting to me about the Christian wrestling is we have wrestling, they have wrestling with Christ at the end of it. We have skateboarding. They have skaters for Christ. We have surfing. They have surfers for Christ. They have their own parallel America. And they've taken all of the things from our popular culture but adapted them to fit their religious agenda. So they do what we do, but then they add Christ at the end of it. And it's really a powerful tool to convert young kids.
And, just speaking of the young kids, you go to a lot of these huge concerts, stadiums sold out with kids dancing to Christian rock. We know how popular that is. Or even just dancing in church. And you speak to some young men who try to explain to you, these virile, big, they look like football players. What's in it for them to be doing this on a Saturday night? Let's just listen to a couple seconds of that.
You don't get AIDS here. You don't get killed going home drunk. She still get high, but it's on Jesus. It's not on something that fades out in the morning.
I've done other things on a Saturday night, but I'm 27 years old. My life has been changed, and it's been changed by being in a place like this. God is good.
Alexander Pelosi, they tell you that this is it. This is where it's at. Did they put their finger on what it is?
It is Jesus Christ. Everything to them is Jesus Christ, and that's all there is. That he provides the answer. The Bible has the answers to every question there is.
It seems like freedom, liberation, intoxication, peace, those words and more.
Yeah, I mean, there's great freedom in believing in the Bible as the word of the Lord because you have the answer to every question. They would ask me something, what do you believe? And I would tell them, but then they'd say, well, where do you get that? And it's hard to come up with an answer. I was raised by nuns. They never told me that homosexuality was a sin. It just never came up. And in 100 years of Catholic school experience with me and all my sisters, we never were told. So that was San Francisco. That was their interpretation. The nuns of San Francisco did not interpret the Bible to say that homosexuality is a sin. Well, in the parts where I was visiting in the Red States, they say, here's my Palm Pilot. Here's the Bible, Leviticus. It says right here. This passage. So they have something they can point to. What do I have? That's what they would ask me. And, I can't really defend my beliefs, but to say that's just what I believe in. They can say, I believe it because it's in the Bible. Hmm. And you can't really fight with the Bible. I mean, you can say, well, that's your interpretation, but they have the words in front of them.
Hmm. Do you miss those characters and that road trip?
Well, I have a newborn baby at home, so I don't miss being alone, driving at night while filming through the Bible Belt. So no, I wouldn't say that I miss them. But I did make a lot of friends, people that I respect and admire, and I think that they have a lot to teach us about political organization and about, the culture wars. And I think we should have an open dialogue with these people because they are Americans and we need to listen to them about, what the future of America looks like.
And, by the way, what does your mother think of it?
We have a separation of church and state in our household. We don't bring our work home. When I talk to my mother, we talk about baby feedings and diapers. We don't really talk about Christians and the Democratic Party. We come home to unplug. That's why she calls me to talk about something other than politics. She spends all day talking about politics. She doesn't want to talk to me about it. And she doesn't really ask me what I think of the way the Democrats are going, and I don't really talk to her about what I think. You know, it just doesn't come up in conversation. We've really never talked about it. She saw the movie at the Washington premiere last week, just like everybody else. She'd never seen any of it, and we never really talked about it. But she liked it because she said, well, you know, we really do need to reach out. The Democrats really do need to reach out to these evangelicals because, you know, there's more than just abortion and gay marriage. There's global warming. There's the war. There are other issues that the Democrats can talk to evangelicals about. And that's, you know, what will be interesting to see in the 2008 presidential election is which candidate has the ability to reach the evangelicals that are tired of just talking about gay marriage and abortion.
Documentary filmmaker Alexandra Pelosi, again, the youngest daughter of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, but a filmmaker in her own right. Her latest film, Friends of God, premieres tonight on HBO. And we rush to say, as we always do with this topic, that it is about a specific mega church, middle of America version of evangelical Christians. Alexandra, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And tomorrow on Here and Now, Stanley Karnow looks back at the tipping point of the war in Vietnam, the Tet Offensive. Also, what's your most memorable concert-going experience? It could be this guy right here, Hendrix. We've got 50 others all tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. Funding for I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A Massachusetts teenager may face homicide charges in an unusual case which hinges on when she took an anti-ulcer medication with the intent to abort an unwanted pregnancy. 18-year-old Amber Abreu, a recent immigrant to Lawrence, Massachusetts from the Dominican Republic, says she took the medication, Cytotec, to end her pregnancy. Now, that's reportedly common in her home country, and we'll learn about the cultural aspects of this case in a moment. But first, the legal case. Amber ended up delivering a premature baby girl who died 4 days later. Since it's illegal in Massachusetts to have an abortion after 24 weeks of pregnancy, prosecutors are now trying to determine when she took the Cytotec. Julie Kirkwood is covering the story for the Eagle Tribune newspaper in North Andover, Massachusetts. Julie, what do we know about this case?
Amber is, she's an 18-year-old teen, Lawrence. According to court documents, she's actually had a pregnancy aborted before. She got pregnant last March, and her mother, a Venezuelan immigrant, paid the money, $200, to get her the abortion. So this fall, when she began to suspect she was pregnant, she took a pregnancy test. It was negative, but she said she could feel something moving in her stomach, and she confided this to a friend who was visiting from the Dominican Republic. And the friend apparently gave her three pills, which she took over the course of 2 days, which were supposed to abort the pregnancy. Now, she says these pills didn't have any warning labels or instructions, although when they're sold in the United States, they do come with very strict warning labels.
And this is the Cytotec, which is normally an anti-ulcer medication.
Exactly, yeah.
And then?
So then on January 6th, Amber experienced abdominal pain after taking the medications and went to Lawrence General, which is a local hospital, where she delivered the baby. One of the first things that tipped off people at the hospital that something was wrong is that she actually left the hospital. The baby was transferred to Tufts New England Medical Center in Boston for neonatal intensive care, and that's where the baby died 4 days later.
And now the question is when she took it. Now, this can be confusing. Amber has been charged with one count of procuring a miscarriage. That charge can carry up to 7 years in prison. But it is legal in Massachusetts to have an abortion if the fetus is less than 24 weeks old. So is it even possible to determine exactly how old to the week this child was?
Oh, we're not sure. That's what they're working on right now, conducting an autopsy. Prosecutors are still waiting to determine if they're going to charge her with homicide. What we do know is that it's illegal to use Cytotec as she used it, as a standalone drug for causing an abortion or a miscarriage. It is legal to use it under a doctor's supervision in conjunction with another drug, and that's the abortion drug known as RU486.
So just to repeat, it would have been legal if she had used the Cytotec with a doctor's prescription for an abortion-inducing drug, but it is illegal for her to use the Cytotec by herself.
Yes.
To procure a miscarriage.
Right.
Amber's bail was initially set at $25,000. It's been reduced to $15,000, and we understand no one stepped forward to pay it.
Nope, she's still held as far as we know.
And just quickly, how is the community there responding to this story?
Well, we've actually found out that there, although not many people know about it, there have been other cases in Lawrence, which has a high population of Latino immigrants and residents. There have been other cases of women using this drug to cause an abortion, and in some cases successfully. And actually, healthcare workers wonder if it's used more often than they realize, because if it is used successfully, women would not even enter the healthcare system. So it could just be happening.
There also is a case of a woman who was jailed for using the drugs.
Yes, in South Carolina.
But Julie, I just want to be clear. In the cases that are anecdotal, was it more than likely prior to this late in the pregnancy, 24 weeks or 23?
Yes, it was, and that's a very important difference.
Julie Kirkwood, staff writer for the Eagle Tribune newspaper in North Andover, Massachusetts. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, we turn now to Ligia Rivera, Director of Community Mobilization Programs at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. And Ligia, I know that in a 2000 study of Dominican women in New York City, you found that 37% were familiar with this technique. Do you have any idea how many women use the technique?
What we know is anecdotic, and we're still in the process of learning and understanding whether Cytotec is used and how often it is used. I think what is important here to highlight is why women find themselves in a situation where they have to turn to Cytotec as an option to terminate their pregnancy.
Tell us that. I mean, first of all, tell us, how is abortion viewed in their home country, and how is Cytotec used in their home country?
For example, we know that many Latinas do not know that abortion is legal in the first place, because in their countries of origin, abortion is illegal. In addition, even when they know that abortion is legal, finding a provider that is proficient in Spanish is very difficult. And as we know, on top of those issues, on top of those barriers, many Latinas are undocumented, so they avoid any type of contact with public service agencies for fear of deportation. So that's the context in which Latinas find themselves in this type of situation.
Well, if you do know that many women don't know the availability of abortion, and also, you know, maybe can't find providers who can speak in their language, what are you doing to address that?
An important aspect of what we do is public education. We try to reach out as much as we can to our communities, and we work with local partners. We also work with community clinics, and there is a lot of stigma behind abortion and a lot of stereotypes about abortion and Latinas. But what we know is that Latinas have abortion. So I think it's important for us to keep that in mind. Between 17% and 20% of Latinas have abortions. And another important piece of this puzzle is that Latinas, even when they know, some of them know that abortion is legal, even when they might speak the language, 30% of Latinas are uninsured. That's a higher rate than we find in African-American communities and in white communities. Latinas rely more on federal funds for the provision of their reproductive health needs than any other group.
Huh.
So any restriction on the use of federal funds to pay for abortion, such as the Hyde Amendment and the funding cuts that some community clinics are experiencing, exacerbate the barriers that Latinas are currently facing.
The Hyde Amendment excludes abortion from Medicaid coverage.
That's correct.
Right. Well, what about birth control? If is it possible that more information about birth control might mean less abortions induced through Cytotec?
Latinas traditionally have a higher failure of contraceptive use. So,
why is that?
Like I said earlier, the lack of access to reproductive health services includes access to birth control pills, condoms, and emergency contraception. So the fact that we're talking about contraceptive use and birth control is also related to the whole spectrum of reproductive health services.
Well, this story here in Boston has certainly put it, as you said, it's been anecdotal, but now this has put it on the radar and something more people will pay attention to. Ligia Rivera, Director of Community Mobilization Programs at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And stay with us, because still ahead, we're going to turn a corner to the world of sports, the young and the very, very old. You're listening to Here Now. Well, she's back. After falling to an 81st ranking in the world and being unseeded in the tournament, American tennis star Serena Williams has reached the finals of the Australian Open. It's her first Grand Slam final in 2 years. She'll meet top-seeded Maria Sharapova on Saturday. On the men's side, Roger Federer awaits the winner of Friday's match between Fernando Gonzalez and Tommy Haas. And here to talk tennis and everything else in the world of sports is our ace. We try to work something like that in every week. Only game host Bill Littlefield. Nice to see you as always.
Hello, Robin. I'm not that old.
Well, you know why I mentioned that? Ahead, we still are going to learn about a new magazine called Geezer Jock. And Bill,
my demographic.
Just listen in is all I can say. But we have the young athletes. I want to actually continue that thought. Geezer Jock, like one of them, 61. I mean, I don't think of that as old anymore.
Well, I don't think of it as old as I used to think of it.
That's right. But Serena Williams is definitely someone that the people were moving, even at her young age, you know, sort of out of the spotlight. But here she comes back. I mean, it's going to lift her ranking, but do you think she has a chance against Sharapova?
Well, it can't help but lift her ranking. She had fallen to 81st.
Right.
But, of course, injuries are the bane of athletes, and injuries explained her ranking because they made it impossible for her to play. This is a real interesting final, I think, because neither of these women has played as brilliantly as they can play. Obviously, they've played well enough to get to the final, but Williams had some kind of lulls in her semifinal match. Sharapova was not as sharp as she has sometimes been. And so it seems to be one of those matches where it kind of depends on who's a little bit not quite as not as good as she used to be.
Right, kind of thing. On that day. Well, number one ranked Roger Federer just steamrolled over American Andy Roddick in the semifinals in straight sets. What was the call there?
6-4, 6-0, 6-2, and it's the kind of match where you would say that Roddick was embarrassed if you were inclined to use cliches, but of course he isn't embarrassed because he still got paid and then he gets to play in the next tennis tournament. So he was beaten. That was simple. And Federer has been doing that to lots and lots of tennis players for quite a long time.
I love watching them both. Closest rival, Rafael Nadal, is already out. And Federer, is he unbeatable?
Well, at this particular time, and especially in the most important matches, he seems to be awfully good in Grand Slams.
Yeah. Well, this is the time of year that I just love. Don't call me on the weekends. The U.S. Figure Skating Championships take place in Spokane, Washington. I love it. But it's a non-Olympic year. So what does this mean? I mean, I'm understanding that we see new talent as some retire. You know, so who should we watch?
Well, it means for most people that Kimi Meisner is the only name they will recognize because all the other names have either moved on to do something like act instead of skate or else they're hurt or else they've decided that they're going to pass up this particular competition.
And for those saying Kimi Meisner,
exactly.
We don't even recognize that one.
I guess the closest thing to a recognizable name besides Kimi Meisner is Emily Hughes, not to be confused with Sarah Hughes.
Right, the sister
act.
Well, turning to football for just a minute, the National Football League and the Players Union announced a new drug testing policy. The players are going to be tested more often. They're going to face more financial penalties if they fail the test. And they're also going to be tested for EPO. That is the thing that increases the number of red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think of these new rules?
It's public relations. It's good public relations to say that your players aren't breaking the rules, and we can prove it with these negative tests. But I don't believe for a minute that the players who are inclined to break the rules will stop breaking them. They'll just have to be more clever, and the technology will have to, as it always does, stay a step and a half ahead of the testing.
Quick look at college basketball. In the men's game, number one ranked Florida won last night. They beat Mississippi by 3 points. In the women's, though, two undefeated teams, both from North Carolina.
Yeah, North Carolina and Duke, and just below them in the ACC, Maryland, which, of course, was last year's NCAA women's champ. So the ACC is rich with great teams, potential winners this time around. The great trend in women's college basketball is more and more and more good teams, and each one with a better chance to win.
And finally, last night, hockey had its All-Star game, and the West beat the East 12-9, but who knew? Middle-of-the-week All-Star game. Hard to find hockey lately.
Yeah, and who knew they would play the game without goalies? 12-9? That's a hockey score?
It's only a game host, Bill Littlefield. By the way, speaking of hockey, he'll have a terrific book about Bobby Orr on his show this weekend. Check it out. And speaking of Bobby Orr, the new magazine, Geezer Jocks, just ahead. And here, I love you, Bobby. Stay with us here and now.
Thanks, Rob.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. These days, no sport is too obscure for its own magazine, but now there's one for readers publishers might have wrongly assumed were more likely to be shopping for Geritol than power bars. It's Geezer Jock, the Masters Sports and Fitness magazine. Its December issue features an 84-year-old swimmer, an 86-year-old biker, and plenty of advice about getting healthy fats into your diet. Sports journalists Steve Bowman and Sean Callahan started Geezer Jock in 2005 with 4 issues. This year they plan to release 8, and they've built up a healthy circulation, if you'll pardon the pun, of 51,000. Sean Callahan is currently editor of Geezer Jock, and he joins us. Welcome.
Thank you.
And what started this?
Well, Steve and I were newspaper reporters in Chicago, and both of us had covered events in Chicago where there was a men's senior basketball league, guys 50 and over playing basketball, mm-hmm. a similar volleyball league, and we became aware of the National Senior Games, which are known as the Senior Olympics. And we thought that the subculture had some legs, and we loved the story, we loved the people that we talked to. We thought that there was some way where we could keep doing it.
Legs indeed, and some of them with new knees and hips, you know, allowing
Absolutely.
Them to go further than ever. And I'm looking at the one of Steve's columns about yet another senior games. It's the Huntsman World Senior Games. There's a lot of competition out there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're in a sport, you can find people in your age group playing almost every weekend of the year, whether it's, you know, softball especially. There's even a men's senior baseball league. It starts at men 28 and over, and there's a 38 and over bracket, 48 and over, and they have tournaments in Las Vegas, a World Series out there, a Fall Classic in Florida, and they get, you know, 1,000 guys out there playing baseball.
Well, in fact, I've seen the tennis championships, and they've got 90, 95 different
right.
categories. And I'm looking here at the list of the winners of the Huntsman World Senior Games, and look, there's Lee and Ruby Hamill of Salt Lake City, and they're playing tennis in their They're 80s, I happen to know some friends. So this is a huge population. Also, I'm sure you were thinking one that might have some, you know, some spare change.
Well, I think so. I mean, the baby boomers are probably the most affluent generation in the history of the world here in the United States. And we felt that there were probably some advertisers who'd want to reach them.
But what about the name of the magazine, Geezer Jock? I know.
Yes, Geezer Jock.
Have you had any backlash from that?
We have gotten some. In the early days, we published 2 or 3 pages of letters in the first issue, people, you know, for the name and against the name. But we thought a lot about the name. Geezer Jock was a name that some of the initial guys that we covered back in Chicago had called themselves. They have a sense of humor about this whole thing, too. But we thought about calling the magazine, you know, Masters Athlete or Senior Fitness Magazine. But we felt those fell flat. And we didn't feel like they captured the exuberance of this movement. You know, Geezer Jock for us is a, you know, it's a new word. And it makes the two words that make it up, geezer and jock, it makes them into two totally different things. So a geezer isn't what you think it is. And a jock isn't what you think it is. Right. I mean, this is a real big sea change in the way people are growing older. They're not stopping playing the games that they loved as kids.
Let's bring a certified geezer jock into the conversation. Rich Abrahams is a 61-year-old record-breaking swimmer in Denver, Colorado. He was featured in the December issue. I'm looking at your picture there. You're in shape, and for good reason. What's your workout like?
I concentrate on intensity, so it varies, a lot of variety and a lot of intensity. Biking, running, lifting weights, all of that adds up to, you know, just some good general fitness which allows you to do your sport.
Well, you're not only running, you're running up the steps of Red Rocks Amphitheater near Denver, stadium steps, so it's quite a run.
Yeah, and the 6,000 foot of elevation doesn't help.
Right. Well, now, what does it do for you?
It does a lot of things. I mean, aside from the feeling of walking with a bounce in your step and just feeling really healthy and strong, it makes you part of a community of shared interest, other people that are doing it with you. You're always learning, believe it or not. If you're dedicated to a sport, there are things in that sport that are changing, and if you want to excel, you pay attention to those sort of things.
Well, I was going to say, do you find, as some master athletes say, that you're actually a better competitor, better athlete, and in better shape maybe than you might have been when you were young and didn't have as much time, for instance?
Well, all of the above. And I competed in college, and my attitude back then was, well, talent should suffice, and you wouldn't have to work that hard. I realize that is not the case, and I work much harder now than I ever did through college.
And yet you still compete against young people. Tell the story of the race. I think it was the Gold Coast Masters in Florida, and there were some world record holders there, and a 47-year-old that you swam against. Tell me about that.
Well, yeah, they had two Olympians on their team, a woman named Dara Torres and Rowdy Gaines. And in these relays, you get to add up all of your ages, and this was a 200-plus relay. So I'm the old guy bringing up the younger guys, and I started just a few tenths of a second ahead of Rowdy to anchor the relay. The announcer got into it, and the crowd got into it, and I was able to hold him off, and he couldn't catch me. And he was a real gentleman about that, but it was very exciting.
He was at your ankles. And then he was at your knees. But yeah, as you say, you felt like a squirrel in a room full of Rottweilers, but you won.
Yes.
And can you, I mean, to win, is it any different when you're older?
You're not swimming really for a team as much as you did in college. I think it's more a question of personal satisfaction. I think your goals are more personal. And believe me, I really do not swim this to try to set records or win, but to achieve my own personal goals.
Right. And you have more. I mean, you say you have goals for doing X, Y, and Z when you're 70. What are they?
My main one would be to break 23 seconds in the 50-yard freestyle at 70. My best time ever in high school was 23.4. It was good enough to get me a college scholarship. My best lifetime in college when I got second in the NC2A championships was mid-21. Last year I went a 22.3, and I really think I can maintain that.
Well, Sean Callahan, again, editor of Geezer Jock, Rich is a really super, you know, he's a master athlete. But how much of this is also about, you know, it's nice to think of having a goal at 70, and maybe that makes you have a better chance of reaching 70?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, there's the health aspect of it. And in our magazine, we write about guys like Rich who are admittedly exceptional athletes, both when they were younger and in staying in shape now. But the magazine is also for people who are looking to get back into sports, looking to start sports, and just stay fit so that they can enjoy life more. I think we found, just from the people that we've seen anecdotally, that you can maintain a very healthy speed in no matter what sport you're doing up until 70, 80, even 90 in some cases.
As you go through it and you see all these, you know, toned bodies, and all the ads are for things like wetsuits and fitness expos. There's only one little giveaway that it might be for people who are in their older years, and that's the go all day without having an embarrassing accident.
Well, right. No matter what good a shape you're in, you're going to have body breakdowns.
It's sort of nice to have it just out there as a fact of life.
I actually think this whole movement is a conspiracy by the orthopedic surgeons.
Job security.
Knee replacements, hip replacements.
That's right. It's a big deal, Rich, isn't it, when you move up in an age group like, oh, great.
I know. This is the only area where you'll hear a 49-year-old woman saying, I can't wait till I turn 50.
Right, because then you're the youngest in the new category.
Right, because you'll be in an advantage for the competition.
That's right. That's Rich Abrahams. He's a 61-year-old record-breaking swimmer in Denver, Colorado. He's featured in the December issue of Geezer Jock. We've also been speaking with Sean Callahan, who co-founded the magazine. And to find out more about getting a subscription, go to our website, here-now.org. Gentlemen, thank you both.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Thanks, Robin.
Something to look forward to. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.